Welcome to the Words Matter Pod with Akil Pinnock, a podcast dedicated to wordsmiths. I'm here at Adane Bookshop in Dumbo, Brooklyn, with owner Darlene Opo. How are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
I'm great.
Good.
So today is a National Independent Bookstore Day.
Yes.
Okay. So I caught her. I caught Adane and Darlene at a great time. A great time for independent bookstores. And yeah, definitely wishing you luck today. With business and conversations and connections of people you run into today. You told me that people come in here and have treat this like therapy sometimes when they walk into the store.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Which is a good thing. Mm-hmm. But sometimes I had to like mentally prepare myself and tell myself like I'm gonna be talking all day. But it's also important that I am, when my customers come in, I'm giving them my full attention, because I like when I walk into the store, it feels like a home, and that's the intention behind the shop, is just making sure that customers feel welcome. I remember I went into a bookstore the other day and it was like so cold, and I was just like wanted to leave because I was just like, this doesn't feel welcome. But I know when I walk into my store, I immediately feel happy. So I'm glad that I set that intention when building it out for my customers.
Mm-hmm. Are you from Brooklyn?
No, I'm originally from the Bronx.
Okay.
Born and raised in the Bronx and Staten Island.
All right.
Moved to Brooklyn. Was in Brooklyn for 10 years. It's so weird because I was doing a calculation the other day. Born in the Bronx, left when I was 11. Staten Island, spent like 1 year elementary, fifth grade, and then middle school, and then high school. And then left Staten Island like 10 years later.
Yeah.
And then Brooklyn was 10 years. So now I'm like in between like different boroughs, just trying to figure out where I want to place my head at. But I actually bought property in Philly.
Oh, wow. Congrats.
So everyone's just like, Philly. I'm like, listen, Philly is thriving right now.
Yeah.
Hopefully if the Sixers win the NBA championship, that's mm-hmm. just going to add more equity to my property.
Yeah.
I know that sounds so crazy, but I'm it's a business person. I look at stuff like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I'm slowly doing the transition to Philly. You know, New York is my heart, but I'm at that point where it's like, you know, you got to live where you can afford it, right? So that's where I'm at right now.
Yeah. So where does your story begin?
Oh, man. You know, I have, like, different parts of my childhood where it's, like, you know, being Nigerian-American. My parents are, like, they were born in Nigeria. We were born here. So I always pride myself on saying that I'm Nigerian-American because, you know, in the household, like, it was full of Nigerian culture. And then when we went to school, it's just, like, straight, like, BX. Like, you know, just... you know, in our neighborhood, and I was speaking to my brother the other day, and he was just like, you know, even though our parents, like, drive us crazy, but we have to be thankful that they, you know, took that time and took us out of that environment.
Yeah.
Me, I was just, you know, I had my core group of friends with my sister and brother. They were, like, teenagers, so my brother was explaining to me. He was like, during that time in the 90s, like, 96, he was just like, our neighborhood in particular, that's when the gangs were starting to form heavy.
Mm-hmm.
So he was just like, you know, our parents had to get us out of there. And he was just explaining, like, I could have been, you know, in jail, locked up for five different times. Who knows?
Yeah.
But I kind of have, like, this love-hate relationship with Staten Island because, you know, I loved it because of the environment that my parents created in the household where it's just me and my siblings. And, you know, we're very close. We love each other dearly, and those are, like, my first friends. But in Staten Island, it's just, like, where's the soul in Staten Island?
Mm.
For some people who grew up there, like, born and raised, me, it was just, like, I just went to school there. And
Wu-Tang.
Staten Island was just, like, I ran track, so we was always in and out the borough.
Yeah.
So for me, track was, like, my escape. So it's, I always tell people, like, yeah, I lived on Staten Island, but I really didn't experience Staten Island the way that other people did. Like, I went to high school, ran track, and that's it. Worked, That's it. As soon as I had a chance to get off the island, I was out of there. Mm-hmm. But shout out to Staten Island, though. It's a borough that has very nice homes.
That's it. That's the most politically correct you could get. Mm-hmm. What makes a kid want to open a bookstore?
You know, my fondest, earliest memory was, anyone that's from the Bronx knows, like, Fordham Road, right? And on Fordham Road used to be this public library that I loved so much. When you grow up in the Bronx, when you're 10, you're really like 15. I'm just going to say how it is, because you see so much in that borough. And for me, we was like 8, 9, like walking to the concourse in Fordham Road by ourselves. Mm-hmm. If you're familiar with that area, it's like 4 2-lane traffic on a concourse. It's a very massive road, but we would, like, venture out and just leave our neighborhood and just go to certain places. And for me, my favorite area in the Bronx is Fordham Road, because it's like a shopping district.
Yeah.
Like, you get everything. You want a nameplate, you go to Fordham Road. You want some sneakers, you want some clothes, you go to Fordham Road. And for me, while everybody loved to shop, I loved the library.
Yeah.
So when we moved, they actually was redoing the branch at the time. But it was just, like, old and antique, and it had all these books, and I would just go there all the time. Every time we had a school trip and they said we was going to the library, I was, like, the first one to bring in my permission slip. That's how much I love the library. And then in my public school, PS 85 at the time, they had, like, this massive library. I remember when we left to move to Staten Island, I did not return the books at all. I kept them because I wanted some part, some piece of the Bronx with me, so I kept the books. But from early on, like, my parents, especially my mom, always encouraged us to read. My sister would make fun of me, and she would say, like, before you even went to kindergarten, you would pack your book bag with books. Like, she was just like, before you even went to school, she was like, you just pack your books. We wouldn't even be going anywhere, and you would just have a book bag full of books just walking around the house. I was just, like, infatuated, because I just love the art of storytelling and being able to escape.
Yeah.
And that was great for me because, again, I grew up with siblings. We all have different personalities.
Yeah.
And for me, it's like I was always the quiet one. Like, just leave me alone. Let me be. When I want to participate in a conversation, I will. But let me be in a corner, mind my business. And at the time in the Bronx, we were living in it was a 3-bedroom apartment, but my sisters and I, we shared one room. So it was like a tiny room. So imagine being around people all the time, right? So from there, you know, once I got into middle school and high school, my love for reading kind of like dwindled just a little bit, but it was really,
you're trying to be cool and stuff.
It was that. And then, you know, I wasn't next to my love, the library, you know, the libraries that were in the area were like far. They weren't walking distance. You had to take the bus and you had to do all types of stuff. And my parents, you know, they really wasn't, like, putting money into the books that I wanted. And my school didn't have a library. My middle school didn't have a library. It was until I remember my aunt. She's a heavy reader. She lives in Oklahoma right now. And she would read a lot of urban fiction books.
Yeah.
And I remember my sister, like, took some books. And the first book that I saw my sister take was Push by Sapphire. And The Coldest Winter Ever by Sister Soulja. What made me pick up the book was obviously the cover with Sister Soulja. I was just like, oh, okay, girl, pink lips, purple cover, interesting, you know? And this is pre-internet, you know, you just read the cover. And I remember I read the back of it. I was like, I want to read this. So I actually read Push first. And I believe I was like 7th, 8th grade. And I wasn't supposed to read it. I actually like stole it from my sister's room and I would hide it. Whenever she would come back, so I used to take her stuff. And I would read it at night, and I was like, this book is, like, captivating. Like, just how it was the first time reading a book from an author's point of view or just a story about a girl that I may not have experienced what pressures went through, but somebody else did.
That you saw on a regular basis.
Yeah, that I saw. And I'm like, I know this girl, right? I know this girl to a T. So then I read The Coldest Winter Ever, and I was just like, this book, even the line itself, if I'm going to repeat the line, but Sister Soulja, when she talked about winter, she said, excuse my language, But she said, I busted out of my mom's P-U-S-S-Y on the coldest winter ever. When I read that line, I was like, mind you, I'm in the seventh grade. Seventh grade, yeah. You're like 13 years old. Again, I was like, man, I know this girl. Like, I know plenty, you know, teens that are experienced this. And from there, you know, I started to read again. So I started to read a lot of, like, romance novels by Eric Jerome Dickey, who is one of my favorite romance, urban, if you want to call it, fiction authors. I found out recently that he passed away last year, and I was devastated because he has a way of really capturing, you know, black romance or what black people are going through. And just the way he incorporates history into his writing, man, he's a phenomenal writer. May he rest in peace. Very phenomenal writer. So there, middle school, and in high school, kind of got lost a little bit. But I went in heavy reading urban fiction. I was reading books that I wasn't supposed to read, like Harlem Girl Lost, True to the Game. You read that book before?
No, but I remember being in high school and all of just the urban fiction books that girls used to read all the time, and the covers would be so ridiculous. It'd be like a.
But we were reading.
Yeah, we were reading. That's a beautiful thing.
We were reading,
thing.
And
yeah.
that's what is important. We were reading, and I remember my sociologist teacher at the time in high school, white lady. She got on my nerves, and I didn't like that she said this. And she was just like, you know, all those urban fiction books that you guys are reading is not reading. And I looked at her, and I was just like, you know, how dare you say that? Even to this day, as an educator, I remember one teacher told me before that, you know, graphic novels is not, because a lot of kids love graphic novels. And he was like, it's not reading. And so another teacher corrected him, and he was just like, that is reading. Like, who are you to say what, you know, is considered reading or not? Graphic novels, I think that's the most intelligent form of reading because you're looking at pictures and you're interpreting pictures and words and you're you know. So my students love graphic novels. If that's what they want to read, that's what I'm going to get them.
Yeah.
And with a lot of just individuals, whether students or adults, a lot of people are just like, oh, I don't read. You know, you just got to find out what works for you. For me, what kept me reading, I loved urban fiction at the time. So being that I was such a hardcore reader, I was able to read Assata Shakur, Malcolm X, stories on the civil rights movement because I read so much. And what actually motivated me more to read more about my history and actually major in African-American studies was the autobiography of Assata Shakur. One of my favorite books because she talked about, I'll never forget the one line in her book when she talked about, what is the president, our president, he was our president at the time, but Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah.
She was just like, if you believe that Abraham Lincoln freed the slaves, then you don't know your history, something to that nature.
Mm.
And I was like, what? Like, I was like, what do you mean? I've been taught all these years that he was responsible for freeing slavery. Like abolishing slavery. And from there, I took off. Like, I remember, I'll never forget when I read that line, I was like, I want to study African-American history. And I started gathering books on history. And just I was just, like, flabbergasted, and I was upset. So I was just like, I feel like my education was taken away from me for what I felt like I deserved to learn about. So my love for reading is a personal thing. It's a personal thing because of, you know, just my childhood love for reading, what it has done for me, and everything of that nature.
I mean, you know, also you coming from a Nigerian American background, and not knowing the full scope of who abolished slavery. Could you attribute that to being Nigerian American and not being coming from a Black American background, and
you say that one more time.
You know, like a lot of Black people. My mom came to this country and she studied African American history in college, but a lot of people who come from Black immigrants don't really understand Black American history because their parents are immigrants.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, could you attribute that to
absolutely?
Why
absolutely. And that was one major thing for majoring as well, majoring in African-American history is because I knew about, you know, my Nigerian background, not even the whole entire African continent, just like, you know, my, because that's what we were raised on. But my parents were immigrants themselves, so they didn't know a lot of things about, you know, U.S. American history at the time. My dad could tell you his experience as an immigrant coming here in the 70s. But if you ask him, you know, about certain movements or the civil rights, he wasn't here at the time. You know, like, he came, he was here after. So he could only tell me his experience with dealing with racism or being an immigrant in New York City. Mm-hmm. So a lot of that stuff was not taught to us at all.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't taught to us at all. Not one bit. So it's interesting that you say that. And, you know, you kind of look at your childhood, and I acknowledge that. And when I speak to my parents and tell them the why, it's just like, you know, I'm American born. Like, this is just as much as I need to know about my African history, I need to know about American history too. It's completely, it was like completely separated, different. And it's not that they didn't know. I think at the time, you know, when you come here, you want to preserve your culture.
Yeah.
You know? So you want to make sure that you still have, you know, you're the person, you're who you are. So I'm pretty sure my dad is, and my mom is just like, you know, we're trying to live the American dream.
Yeah.
But live the American dream as immigrants and make sure we provide for our family here and back home. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, when I think about it, when I speak to my mom and dad, they just, their stories are more of like not being from here.
Yeah.
Yeah. So their stories are never, you know how you hear some, you know, your friends' parents who were born here that went through certain movements. Well, my parents is like their experience here, like, you know, how they were treated and what they went through. That's the stories that I get.
Yeah.
What are the steps to becoming a bookstore owner? Because, you know, what happened between the time of you falling in love with books as a kid and being in love with that bookstore on Fordham Road and to eventually opening a bookstore? Like, what happened in between?
Absolutely. It was being a teacher. It was, you know, studying African American history, being a teacher, being in, you know, in education and noticing that, you know, the literacy rate is really low in America, not just amongst kids, teens, but amongst adults too. You know, I'm gonna be very honest. And for my students, pushing them to read, in New York City, we have to take a state test. It's called ELA. And that's like a very hard test for a lot of kids. Yeah. And a lot of that is consistent with making sure that they are understanding the nature of like reading the text, comprehension, understanding context, language, and how you develop those skills, not only just test-taking skills, but how you develop those reading comprehension skills is that you're consistently reading all the time, and diversifying what you're reading as well. So, you know, being a teacher, I saw firsthand when I provided my student with a book of their choice, you know, of what they wanted to read, and I noticed that their reading level started to get better. They wanted to read different types of books. They wanted to read books with characters that look like them. And I was just, you know, I called myself the book dealer because I literally was, like, giving out books.
Yeah.
They literally would come to my classroom in the middle of a lesson, "Miss Opal, do you have a book for me?" And I would literally stop 1 second, and I would literally give them a book. It was to the point I created my own library in my classroom, and it felt good.
Yeah.
It felt good that kids came to you, and these are young, you know, middle school kids. They came to you and they wanted to read because they trusted that you was going to provide them with, you know, things that they wanted to read. And that was my favorite thing to do in the school system. Every time they came, they knew that I had what they wanted, and that was that. I gave it to them. So that inspired me to open a store. And just visiting different stores throughout New York City. One of my favorite stores, I call her the OG. know, Sisters Uptown. She's been doing this for a long time, like very, very long time. Mm-hmm. And I have so much like respect and admiration for her because, you know, she services the community. When you go into her shop, it feels like home. Like you feel like you go into your grandmother or your auntie's shop. And, you know, I go in there and I ask her, like, you have this book, and she has it. And if she doesn't have it, she'll tell you she can get it, you know? Another bookstore that I loved, it was in downtown Brooklyn on Livingston Street. I think it was like A&B Bookstore. I forgot the name. But they would have books that you could never find. And that's what I loved.
Yeah.
It was like books that were like banned in the U.S.
Wow.
You know, like, I remember I had this one book called Slavery in New York City. It was like a small 150-page book. And I got it, and I was like, oh, my goodness. I was like, New York has such a dark history. Like, I was like, everywhere you walk is like a burial ground. I was like so shocked. And I remember I gave it to my sister to read. She was like, what did you just give me to read? I was just like, yeah, this is the city we live in. And she tried to get it herself.
Financial District.
Yeah, Financial District. And I remember she went to go search to find the book herself. And she was like, you know, this book is like $400 online right now.
Wow.
And I got the book for like $15. But that goes to show you, like, that book is so important. And they, and you know, there's a newer version by a different author, but that book, something about that book was special. But, you know, just traveling to different stores and just always, you know, spending half my check at a bookstore, literally. So last, what is it, 2021? Anyone that knows me, especially my teacher friends, they know that's all I would talk about. I would be sitting down like, man, I just want my bookstore. Like, literally, I was just sitting out of nowhere. I just want my bookstore. And, you know, the pandemic opened up a lot of things. It was a gift and a curse at the same time. You know, we lost a lot of lives. But yeah. I think it also showed people that, you know, for me, it showed me, like, it's now or never. You know, that's how I seen it. Like, who would have thought we would ever go through something like this? And I remember sitting home and I was just like, am I going to do this forever? You know, like, I love education, but I also want the freedom in education, the freedom to express to my students, like, hey, there's options in life. Yeah. You can do this. In certain schools, you can't do that. They don't want you to, they want you to be like, college is the end all be all. Mm-hmm. You know, some kids don't want to go to college.
Yeah.
So I wanted to create a space where I could have students feel like they're free. They can read the books that they want to read. Because we're living in a time frame where, you know, you have certain states, certain states are banning certain books in schools. You know, is CRT, critical race theory.
Yeah.
You know, we're literally like, there. I think it's in Virginia. Don't quote me on this. It might be in Virginia, where you could literally, parents could call a hotline if they found out that their kids are learning about racism or Black history in the classroom.
Meaning they're just learning about America.
Right. Why is that a problem for you? You want to know why it's a problem? Because it's going to force you to have empathy. It's going to force you to start to do the work along with us. You know what I mean? I'm going to end this with this. I was I taught fifth grade. And I remember I was reading a textbook. We had our history time, and we got to the chapter of slavery, favorite topic to discuss and teach. And the chapter was probably like 3 pages. I'm like, I'm not doing this. Yeah. So I literally went through, changed the lesson a little bit, and I was like, you know what, to evoke discussion, like to get our fifth graders talking about this, because our kids want to learn about their history. Mm-hmm. They want to. They yearn for it. And I was like, you know, I'm going to put the documentary by Ava DuVernay, 13th, on. Mind you, these are fifth graders. When I mean that classroom was quiet, you would have thought it was Saturday morning, you know, Cartoon Network is on and they're watching their favorite cartoon. It was silent.
Fifth graders.
Wow. They were silent. And I, you know, I'll never forget that moment. I had one kid in my classroom. He was white because it was in the Bronx. It was very diverse. School, but he was literally like the only white kid. And he looked at me and he said, Miss Opo, why were my ancestors so mean? I didn't know what to, I just looked, I froze. I literally froze. I was like, but I think about that. And if you think about it now, that's going to destroy white supremacy. It's going to have people actually say, like, you know, this was wrong. We have to change the narrative. We have to look at, you know, American culture and what it has done to black people. It's going to force you to do something. So, of course. So, for me, opening up this store, you know, I have titles in your face, you know, that may make you uncomfortable, you know. And I'm not doing it on purpose. It's just something that we need to talk about. So, when I shop for books, I shop for books that's going to make you think. It's going to make you want to change a certain part of you within to do better for your community. And that's the purpose of having this store, is to, you know, have people learn about African-American history, have people support more authors of color, have people question, you know, what's going on in the world. And it's so many different things. And it just goes from just my experience, just, you know, being here on this earth.
When did you stop teaching?
So I'm still an educator. Okay. I'm no longer in the classroom full time per se, but I work with a great organization called Pencil, where they connect business corporations with school. They partner with schools, and they have these partners come in to teach about career readiness, financial literacy, networking, personal branding. Mm-hmm. It's a great organization that I love because it's something that is, you know, lines up with my mission, just being an entrepreneur and being an educator. And I think the two connect because, you know, we go through 12 years of schooling before college.
Yeah.
But once we leave high school, it's a whole different world, mm-hmm. you know. So I look at education where we have to start teaching them more about career readiness or financial literacy, which is so important. Also talking about the networking aspects as opposed to like testing.
Yeah.
I feel like they should bring a lot of, you know, schools that focuses on trade back. If it was up to me, I have a school where kids are there for half the day. They're getting their, you know, their four core subjects, and then they're going to their internships and then learning about their craft. Because at least they have, you know, a chance to learn about what they want to do early, as opposed to after college, it's like, this didn't work for me. You know, like, at least they're testing many different career focuses and saying, this is what I want to do. So if it was up to me, I have my own school that focuses on something else. I'm a manifest that, just like how I manifested the bookstore.
Yeah. Or even, you know, just even if it's not like a vocational thing for whatever you want to specifically do, it gives you the option to try out different fields, you know, kind of like how you go to college and you will be a liberal arts major. And then, you know, after taking some liberal arts classes, you figure out what you want to major in. Yeah, so I definitely feel you on that as well. I definitely feel you. I mean, what was it like starting a business in the middle of a pandemic?
For me, it wasn't as hard.
A brick and mortar.
Yeah, it wasn't as hard as people, you know, make it think. Because I had, you know, I'm an entrepreneur. I had a business. I have a business with my younger sister prior to opening up the store. To me, this was second nature. I feel like I kind of lucked out because we have all of these empty storefronts around New York City.
Yeah.
So to me, it was just like, hey, you know, this benefits me just as much as it benefits, you know, my management company, you know, because it's like at the end of the day, they need these spaces to be filled. I'm gonna just keep it 100. But for me, it's like, I just did it. But I also made a sacrifice. At the time, you know, I got rid of my apartment. And I kind of was like floating around. I was at my parents' house for a little bit, but I got rid of my apartment. I was just like, you know what? For me to have this, some type of cost from my expenses has to go.
Yeah.
And I chose to sacrifice my personal space to have this store. So don't make it seem like, hey, I just decided to spend money on a brick and mortar. No, I had to let go of my personal space. And anyone that knows me, that's very big for me.
Yeah.
Like, I need my personal space. I need my apartment or whatever the case may be. So I was just like, you know, let me cut down on costs. And I did this. Yeah. So I found this place. I originally wanted to be in Bed-Stuy, but the store at the time, it was tiny. I originally wanted a tiny store, but then I found this space, and I was like, you know, Dumbo has always been a place that I will come to get away from, you know, the bigger neighborhoods of Brooklyn. Always love Brooklyn Bridge Park, and you know, it's foot traffic, but it's like it's a neighborhood compared to what it used to be. But
it's a
you
small
know,
neighborhood.
Yeah, too. it's quiet. Like, don't nobody really bother you. It was great. So a lot of people were just like, you know, why this location as opposed to like, you know, somewhere on like Flatbush or North Shore of that nature. I was just like, I love those areas. That's where I lived in Brooklyn, but in Bed-Stuy. But I was just like, I wanted something where, you know how you're walking in New York City and you pass a store and you have to like break your neck twice to know what it is? Because it's like, wait, where did this come from?
What do they do?
That's how I was. I wanted to be off the grid. I purposely wanted to be off the grid. Because I wanted people to find it. Like that store that you just walking by and it's just like, what's this? And it's like that. I love seeing customers walk by and then come back. Like I literally would see them. Yeah. I watch them through the window and they're like slowing down and they're looking. I'm just sitting there watching. And then next thing you know, a minute or two later, they pop in and they just want to come in and then they end up loving it. That's it, like how I built my clientele was so natural and genuine. Like, I didn't force it upon you. It was just like, come and visit. And it spread by word of mouth. Like, no PR, no marketing, no nothing. Like, when I started, I didn't tell nobody what I was doing. Probably, like, my sister knew. But she probably didn't know I was going to go full force because she thinks I have a habit of, like, I'm such a creative that she's just like, you're always doing something. So, no, I didn't tell nobody about it. I sent an invite to my friends and family. I said, hey, I'm opening a store. They was like, what? You're opening a store? I said, yep. Like, May 1st, tomorrow to be exact. They came in, and they was just like, what in the hell is this? But it was just me, like, in here for 3 months, just creating the space. You know how Kanye says, like, what's on his song? I forgot what song that is. And he was just, like, in the house making multiple beats for 3 summers, whatever the line is.
Making 5 beats a day. For 3 summers.
That was me. Like, I literally locked myself in here, and I fell in love with the space, and I put all of my heart and soul into creating the space. And then May 1st, I opened, and I was just like, come visit. And from there, people would post it. And I'm not a big IG person. Like, I love it for business purposes and exploring and finding people. But I, you know, and from there, I got, like, my first feature in Vogue because a friend posted on her stories, and her friend was like, what's this? I want to write about it.
Yeah.
And then it just took off from there, just naturally.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about, you know, why you didn't open. You kind of answered that for me. But why you didn't open a store in, you know, a more predominantly black neighborhood in Brooklyn, like Flatbush, Crown Heights?
No, that's the goal. You know, it's not something, and, like, I wanted to be off the grid, but, I mean, honest, Flatbush and those places are expensive.
Yeah.
You know, people think Dumbo is expensive, but a storefront there, you know, was a lot of money, and I wanted to work with what I have. But the goal, the ultimate goal is to be in all 5 boroughs. Because I'm such a hardcore New Yorker, even Staten Island, as much as I can't stand Staten Island, like, that's part of my history. That's part of, you know, my DNA. So for me is to have the next, God willing, you know, I want to be in Harlem. Cause I love Harlem so much.
Yeah.
Like Harlem is blackly black to me. People's like gentrification. I'm like, no,
it's still very black.
Harlem is still very soulful. Wherever you go, I don't care what nobody says. Harlem still has its DNA embedded in Harlem.
Mm-hmm. And natives still live there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, this store is obviously in Brooklyn, and Brooklyn is changing, and it's changed rapidly due to gentrification. With the change in demographics in Brooklyn, specifically this neighborhood, you know, Dumbo was prime real estate. How is the pro-black artwork and the imagery and the content of the literature that you sell, how is that received in this neighborhood?
It was, you know, the support has been, very, very good. There's no, I mean, I had one customer come in and say, like, do you sell books only by black authors? And I confidently said, yes. like, yes.
I love it.
You know, and it's, to me, it's just like, yes, this is a black-owned bookstore that focuses on black culture. Like, when you walk in here, it's just blackness. Like, it is what it is. But who's to say it's not for you? It's for everybody.
Yeah. Right? It's American history.
It's American. It's for world everybody. History. You yeah. might, it's going to be a little different from you because you're going to get this journal with this black girl with this afro on it. You can still buy it, right? But it's not excluding you. It's just letting you know, like, hey, this is what I sell. This is what I'm proud of. This is what... Yeah. This is what we need. It is like a mini museum when you walk in here, you know? So it's been received well. A lot of titles that sell are like Baldwin, Morrison, like anything that's like historical fiction from these known authors that sells very well amongst, you know, customers.
Yeah.
I don't know how to say it, that are not of, you know, African-American descent. I don't know. Yeah. I'm like, sometimes you gotta be politically correct with these terms. I'm like, it confuses me sometimes. But no, it's been received well. Like, you can see some customers come in here that are not black or brown people, and you can see the discomfort. But for me, I don't make you feel uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. You know, I make you feel comfortable. So when they come in, I have a conversation with them. That's my favorite thing to do is literally have conversations with customers. Like, I never shy away from having a conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's disarming. And, I mean, it's not like it's not like you got a sign that says, on the window that says blacks only or something.
So. Right. No, this is for this is for everyone. But know that it's centered around African-American culture. That's what I'm very, you know... That's how it stands. That's what it is. And, you know, this is a community that is very gentrified. But I'm not going to shy away and stop selling what I want to sell because of the demographic.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not going to do that.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is kind of similar to, you know, you having this location in this predominantly white space. Being in education, is it hard to include books that you've read into your curriculum?
Yeah, it is hard. It's hard, one, because, you know, some parents, to be honest, they don't want their kids. It's not that they don't want them reading it. It's just they don't want them reading it at that particular age.
Yeah.
That's what I found. It might be different for everybody else.
But then at what age?
Right. That's true. Because I believe it was Jason Reynolds that said it. I think he said, To Kill a Mockingbird, that book, it wasn't for me. I got to find the correct quote. But when I read that quote, I was like, that's so interesting because in one of the schools I worked at, they had the eighth graders reading it. And at the time, you know, they were not engaged with the book.
Mm.
Like, they, because, you know, To Kill a Mockingbird, that's like high school level.
Yeah, I read that in 10th grade.
Right, and they were reading this in the 8th grade. And I remember speaking to my principal and the curriculum specialist at the time. I'm like, you know, this book, I know we want to push them to read advanced books, but it's kind of hard to get them engaged if they can't really relate to what's going on. They can't even understand it yet. So I was like, with kids, what I noticed for school is, like, y'all not taking baby steps. It's, like, full-on force. And I'm just, like, you know, it's, like, a one-size-fits-all model.
Yeah.
Where it's just, like, everybody has a different reading level. So if you have someone that's reading on a second, third grade level, why do you have them reading To Kill a Mockingbird right now? Mm. I'm like, you have to kind of introduce certain, you have to meet them at that level. And they will grow if it's consistent. But it's a lot of things that I disagree when it comes to the education system because it's like, you know, they keep pushing this content on kids that they're not ready for it yet.
Yeah.
They're not ready for it yet.
Yeah.
And, you know, I voiced my opinion a lot when it comes to curriculum content because, again, I'm a firm believer, like, kids teach you how they want to be taught. I always say this. Kids teach you how they want to be taught. And if you're not listening to them, it's going to be difficult to get them to the level that you want them to be. I say that passionately.
Yeah.
Like, I listen to my students. If I have a lesson and it's planned and I worked all night on it, and I come in, I'm like, all right, we're going to learn about this, and they're not engaged, I completely stop. And I ask them, hey, what is it that you want to do today? I want to do it this way. Mm. Like, you got to let go of the control a little bit. And when you have an educator that's like that, that listens to their students, they have higher test scores. They have higher attendance rate. They have higher communication, you know, with parents and student respect because you're listening to them. And when it comes to curriculum content, it's like everyone's doing it in a way where it's based on their needs and not the children's needs. Like COVID, you know, opened up, you know, it basically pulled off the Band-Aid off of a deep wound that wasn't healed yet. You know what I mean?
How kids are being disserviced.
They're being disserviced. Yeah. So it's like, as an educator taught me something, like education can change because we adapted to what happened so fast, you know, like we had to like so fast. I'm just like, it can change. Now, what are you going to do about it? Right. You notice that some kids do. I had kids who were failing during COVID was doing exceptionally well. Mm. Right. I had kids who were doing great in school that weren't doing well.
Yeah.
So it's like you have to ask yourself, hey, can we actually maybe do a hybrid model when it comes to education? Or can we create a system where, you know, kids are getting the attention that they need? Because it's like we're going back into the classroom with like 25 plus kids all over again and not realizing that a lot of these kids went through a lot of mental health issues. Like, depression was at an all-time high.
Yeah, and then COVID would trigger it.
Right. So I had to ask, like, all of these high educational officials, like, what are you doing to change the narrative when it comes to education in America? Because right now, I think number one, I know China up there when it comes to education. Yeah. But... you know, like, especially New York City. New York City is one of the main cities where the resources are in abundance when it comes to education. In abundance.
But it's not being allocated correctly?
I don't think it's being allocated correctly. It's not. It's always an issue when it comes to education. Like, especially when it comes to our black and brown kids, it's always an issue. Like, oh, we didn't have enough this, or funding wasn't here, or this and that wasn't here. It's just like, yo, cut the crap. Like, get it together already.
But that's, you know, it's not prioritized. It's not prioritized.
It's not. They didn't prioritize education during COVID either. They didn't. Like, when it comes to technology, students didn't have proper Wi-Fi. Like, it was so mind-boggling to me. Like, our internet bill went up, but kids still didn't have Wi-Fi. Like, you started to see the difference between, you know, class system. Yeah. You know, kids didn't have computers. Kids had to be parents when they were home. Like, a lot happened. So a lot of funding needs to be invested into the emotional well-being of our students, and as opposed to, like, testing all the time. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know.
Because it affects a performance. Yeah. It's kind of underestimated how important your mental health, your sanity is when it comes to performing with anything.
Right. Elon Musk actually took his kids out of the school they were going to, and he created his own school. Because he was just like, I didn't understand or like what they were learning in school, so I just created my own school. I was like, this guy, Elon Musk. Like, this guy. But, and another thing is, like, parents don't understand their power when it comes to education. Like, as a parent, if my child is coming to me and they're saying, you know, I had one parent tell me, I remember a student, he wasn't doing too well in history. And I spoke to the parent and I was like, you know, X, Y, and Z, you know, what's going on with his history. And she was just like, he just feels like he's not learning what he wants to learn about, and that's Black history. Come on now. Like, you get what I'm saying? So it's not saying that he's not intelligent. He's telling you, like, I don't want to learn about this. Or if we are learning about this, how can we figure out how to make it engaging or tailored to everyday life? Like, he literally told you this. Like, it's not that I don't, you know history. It's just not engaging to me.
Yeah.
I'm not interested in it. So as an educator, what are you going to do? Because there's multiple kids that feel that way. That's just one that's speaking up for his educational rights. Mm-hmm. I call it educational rights.
Nah, it is a right.
It's right. You have a right. So when I say parents have so much power, like if you really, at the end of the day, these schools are businesses, right? Like, it's free education, but it's the businesses, because how they get their money is through funding. Funding by the city, funding by the state. Funding by the city and the state. And, you know, if you decide that you want to take your child out because you don't like, you know, the higher-ups, or your child is not getting the attention that they need, and you take them to a different school, and multiple parents start to see that, and once you have low attendance or not the amount of kids in the school system, like, that school ends up kind of sort of losing funding.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's basic math.
And then, like, add in, like, property taxes and stuff like that. It definitely has an effect on if a school's going to survive.
So if a white parent in Nebraska could fight to ban African-American history in schools, you can fight for your students' education as well.
Yeah.
Fight back. This is what I want.
Yeah, so, you know, a few more questions. In a microwave society where television is catered towards binge watching and albums, and songs are shorter to increase replay for streams, and, you know, does a task like reading that requires patience, silence, stillness, and living with art still have a place in America that prioritizes entertainment over education?
You said, does reading still have
a place?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Having a store has kind of solidified that. Like, people still read.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had someone tell me, like, do people still buy books, still read? I said, absolutely. There's an influx of people who love the physical holding or reading of a book, you know? Whether it's, you know, through hardcover, or, you know, you're reading online, like, it's always going to be there, absolutely.
Yeah. And, you know, what's next for Darlene Opal and Adane Bookshop?
As I mentioned before, like, my dreams, the manifestation is having a bookstore in all five boroughs of New York City, but also expanding the space to cater more to writers, to have a space where they could come and write their books, having a larger community space where I'm holding workshops. I love learning. I'm a person, like, I'm always learning, so I want to incorporate that into Adane, where there's weekly workshops where, you know, people are learning about financial literacy or learning how to do certain things that cater to their interests and needs.
Okay. And why do words matter to you?
Words matter because it holds meaning. You know, words are power. I'm going to think about that today. Hopefully I'm answering this correctly. I was like, man, years ago, I always said I want a bookstore, and here I am celebrating National Independent Bookstore Day. Like, my words hold meaning.
Yeah.
Like, if you say you want to do something, hold on to that and complete that mission. Words are powerful. Words are completely powerful.
All right. Thank you, Darlene Opal.
You're welcome.
Owner of Adane Bookshop in Dumbo, Brooklyn. Thank you for sharing a little bit about your journey and owning a bookstore and your life. And, you know, really your life's work as an educator and lover of books. So thank you very much. And for everybody watching, please like, comment, and subscribe to the Words Matter Network YouTube channel. And follow on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Mm-hmm. And thank you. Thanks again.
You're welcome. Thank you so much.
Words matter.
Okay.